Detroit, Michigan, and case number 130492, City of Detroit versus Syncora Guarantee Incorporated et al.
Okay, let's address the automatic stay issue.
Your Honor, could I interrupt them with two preliminary matters,
sure.
If that's okay? My colleague, Ms. Ball, is going to argue the stay motion, but two things I wanted to get back to Your Honor on. One of them was, in light of Your Honor's willingness to have this hearing so quickly this afternoon, I wanted to indicate that the city is willing to dissolve the TRO. So prior to the automatic stay motion being heard, we thought we should tell you that. The second thing is with regard to the data room. I wanted to be very clear that the city very much agrees with Your Honor that we should be as transparent as we possibly can be with regard to documents affecting the city and its citizens. And what we would propose, though, is as much as we agree with that, there are some documents. We talked about the 70,000 or so pages that are in that data room over the break, and there are certain documents that we have concerns about. There's really kind of two categories. One is documents that involve individual privacy issues. There are some documents relating to different employee salaries, compensation, benefits, Social Security numbers and whatnot that we would be very reluctant to have disseminated publicly, for obvious reasons. And then secondly, in connection with sort of some of the pension assessments, the city agreed to an agreement with Milliman, which is a pension actuary. And as part of the city's agreement, we agreed to an NDA with Milliman. So anyone who has come into the data room since then can get access to the Milliman documents, but also has been required to sign an NDA. We're happy to talk to Milliman about that, but that was the other category that we were concerned about that was obviously had some sensitivity as well. But what we would propose that is that if it was all right with Your Honor, that we go through, call out any of those documents that we have those concerns about, and approach Your Honor with a motion for protective order very, very quickly. We don't think any of this stuff has any relevance to the ongoing assumption motion. But if we determine that the protective order motion has to be filed, to get it filed in the next day or two, and then come back perhaps next Wednesday, if Your Honor was amenable to that, to argue that if there were certain documents that we thought really should remain under seal and require further protection.
That makes sense to me, Your Honor. I think it switches the burden a bit. Instead of saying it's all confidential until it's not, it says it's all not confidential unless it should be.
All right, so this will solve the issue you raised initially about discoverable material. Yes?
Hilton for Detroit Entertainment and Greektown Casino. We've been told that my clients aren't eligible for the data room, that they won't tell the criteria for who is eligible for the data room, which this may be great for these two parties, but it doesn't help for the rest of us. I don't know what the criteria is for who can have access.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Guy Neal, Sidley Austin for National Public Finance Guarantee Corp. I rise to address the Milliman issue. The city has taken the position that in order for parties in interest and creditors to have access to these actuarial reports and valuations of their post-employment benefits, OPEBs, that you need to release Milliman. You have to execute a third-party release. We have not executed that release. We don't believe it's appropriate that we need to enter into a release in order to obtain these materials. If Mr. Shoemaker's opinion
of what?
Excuse me, release of any and all claims that one may have against Milliman. Not saying we have claims, but I'm not sure why one needs to release a party in order to get access to information that may become public. If it's the city's position that they're going to arrive at it, they're going to evaluate what needs to be public and what needs not to be public by the next hearing, we're happy to work with the city on that. if they have a stated position that they're going to hold firm to this third-party release and the parties need to sign it, I'd like to have that addressed today. So.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Robert Gordon on behalf of the Detroit Retirement Systems. I would echo the comments of Mr. Neal on that point. There already have been also, just for the court's edification, releases or information provided by the city about some of those Milliman quote-unquote reports, and I use that term loosely because I don't believe they are reports. They are letters, they are analyses, but they're not actuarial reports. But, for example, there was a June 4 letter from Milliman that was in that data room that was subject to these confidentiality agreements, but then there's been information released by the city about those reports. So there's additional issues about whether things that are in that data room and that might have been arguably at one time subject to confidentiality are still subject to it. So I welcome having that discussion at next week's hearing. I don't think anyone will be prejudiced in the interim. Thank you.
And, Your Honor, that is what I was talking about, is that the city was required to enter into this contract with Milliman, and that's who we would like to talk to about addressing the concerns that were just raised about those documents. As to the initial...
Well, before we move on from that, please ask the people with this firm that if they're not willing to excuse what is apparently your contractual requirement to get a release from the people who see their work product, they need to come to court next week and talk with me about it.
Be happy to do that, Your Honor. And then as to access to I think it was Detroit Entertainment, again, I considering that this is the approach that we think should be taken, and they would get access like any other objector or party.
All right. So we'll look forward to your motion in the next day or so. Ms. Ball?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. Corinne Ball on behalf of the City of Detroit. Your Honor, I rise to do a number of things, but I thought it might be helpful, court's indulgence, if I provided the context in terms of the nature of the asset that we're talking about this afternoon. The casino tax revenues are probably the highest quality revenue stream the city has. It certainly is one of the largest, and we believe the most stable tax stream that the city has, generating in excess of $175 million a year and forecast to generate roughly that much in at least each of the next 10 years. Being able to use this valuable revenue stream is pivotal to the overall resolution of this case and the rehabilitation of the city. Another point that's been bouncing that perhaps we could assist the court are the numbers that have been discussed in connection with the swap. And Your Honor may wonder why. With these particular swaps, which are between the counterparties and the service corporations, the termination value, Your Honor, floats inversely with interest rates. So as interest rates rise, the termination value is reduced. So that as of now, I am told the discounted price to free up this revenue stream is less than $200 million, and in fact estimated at $190 million. To date, I think there has been no debate in any of the three litigations involving the casino revenues that if the swap obligation is discharged, the lien on these revenues is released. I also think there is no debate that Cencora has not paid anything on the swaps and that there are no amounts due. Moreover, Your Honor, absent the forbearance agreement, were the swap counterparties to exercise their alleged rights under Section 560 to terminate the swap, by our calculation, as is reflected in Mr. Orr's affidavit, Cencora's exposure is capped at $27 million. Your Honor, as is obvious to me, but sometimes not as obvious to others, given the pendency still of litigation and the fact that the city has no assurance that the settlement with the counterparties will be approved. It may, in fact, flounder or fail. As is obvious from the 13 objections filed to date, there are key issues as to which the city is not prepared to concede any of these points today, since it doesn't know where the settlement will end up. But certain issues, Your Honor, we think may be raised this afternoon. And I wanted to share with you our view that we'd like to make certain assumptions during our argument this afternoon. Key among those issues which are being settled, should the settlement and assumption motion be approved and succeed, is: are the casino wagering tax revenues special revenues within the meaning of 9022? There is dicta in the Jefferson case cited by Cencora. And, Your Honor, I know there are three JEFCO decisions that have been cited frequently with you. I'm referring to the decision on the receivership, which is reported at 474 BR 28, suggesting that a revenue picture like ours, it may or may not be special revenues. So we are reserving that issue. Obviously, Your Honor, we're also not prepared to concede that the swap is valid or that the pledge of the revenues are valid. But having from the outset reserved on those issues, we think we can still address the stay's applicability to the wagering tax revenues. I was impressed by Cencora's statement of yesterday, where for the first time they asserted that the casino tax revenues, the wagering tax revenues payable by casino owners to the city, are not property of the city. And for that proposition, and Your Honor will have to excuse me because we'll be referring to New York cases a lot this afternoon, as many of these documents are governed by New York law, they point to cases which there's only one common theme among the escrow cases cited by Cencora in support of that proposition. And the common theme is you have to go to the underlying agreement and you have to look at it and see what it says. So if we go to the key agreement, which is the collateral agreement, which, as Your Honor knows, Cencora is not a party to, the agreement has a definition of pledged property in Section 1.2, which keys into the definition of revenues that are pledged, and ultimately to the city's tax, wagering tax revenues. So I think that the agreement is fairly clear that these revenues are property of the city, and the remedy section, and in particular Section 11C of that collateral agreement, confirms that the revenues remain property of the city in these accounts and cannot be accessed except with an appropriation by the city of its revenues to that purpose. So I think this agreement, were one to read it, is fairly clear that these revenues are and remain property of the city. But I think we would then turn, Your Honor, beyond the agreement to the decision, again, by Judge Bennett in ruling on the receivership motion. You may recall that the Monolines and other warrant holders in that case sought to restore the receivership in the context of Jefferson County's Chapter 9. Judge Bennett spent a very thoughtful opinion. And in that, he concluded that the pledge revenues, even though in possession of a receiver appointed by a state court, remained property of the Chapter 9 debtor. And as Your Honor knows, ultimately did not restore the receivership, and did say that these properties are protected by the stays of 362A and 922. So I think we have the general proposition, look to the agreement, as well as a very specific one in Chapter 9, and that was an exceptionally well-reasoned opinion. I also think, Your Honor, that there should be no doubt that the casino tax revenues, technically wagering tax revenues, are taxes within the meaning of Section 922A2, which has a very specific reference to taxes being protected. While we're not prepared to concede, as I indicated already, Your Honor, that casino revenues are special revenues, assuming arguendo for this afternoon that they are special revenues within the meaning of Section 9022, there are still two problems. It's not clear to us that Cencora has standing, since it's not a secure party, and it cannot apply these revenues, that it has standing to raise or to be within the protection of 922 at all. It's not a party. These properties were not pledged to them. But more importantly, if one actually looks to the words of 922, literally it says that the stay does not apply to the application of special revenues to the payment of indebtedness. As I think I've already shared with Your Honor, there are no amounts owing under the swap, and there is no indebtedness remaining to be paid currently due on the swaps. So we think reliance on 922D is misplaced for two reasons. And Your Honor, if I thought it might be most helpful if I went to 922A2 first, it's a very narrow argument, and then if Your Honor would still like us to argue the applicability of 362B17, we're prepared to do that. I don't think there's any debate that wagering taxes are taxes. I also think, Your Honor, that the 11th Circuit, in a case called In re Patterson, and perhaps at this point, Your Honor, I have assembled a listing of the authorities that I'd be using. Would it be helpful to the court so they don't have to keep reporting them? I also have some for some court. May I approach, Your Honor?
Yes.
Your Honor, the 11th Circuit case named In re Patterson, the 11th Circuit has told us that a credit union's action to freeze revenues constitutes a violation of the stay as an act to enforce a lien. That particular passage appears at 967 Fed Second at 512. We also have one of your colleagues from the Southern District of Ohio in a case called In re Figures. In that case, the court was confronted with a refusal to release funds, which the court similarly found a violation of the stay as a prohibited enforcement and collection action. So, Your Honor, I think we now have freezing or refusing to release is enforcing a lien. And we have taxes. So, plain meeting for this afternoon's purposes, the casino wagering tax revenues, there should be a stay protecting them from enforcement of a lien. Now, what else do we know about a stay under Chapter 9? Again, thanks to Judge Klein and Stockton.
Well, the question that Cencora raises is, how is U.S. Bank's act in allowing the funds in the subaccount to accumulate rather than to turn it over to the city a violation of the stay, an exercise of control,
Your Honor,
assuming it is property of these debtors.
I think,
Your
Honor, that's the Southern District of Ohio. That's enforcement of a lien, refusing to release revenues. Similarly, Your Honor, I think that Cincora has somewhat overstated the Supreme Court's ruling in Strumpf. Your Honor may recall that the Supreme Court did find in Strumpf that freezing revenues for a short duration was not a violation of the stay. But it was really a stopgap measure, if one looks to that case at 516 U.S. 19 and 20, to get to the bankruptcy court to seek relief from the stay. Your Honor, U.S. Bank has been releasing revenues without a hitch until June 17th, when communication started from Cincora. There were all the events that were alleged in Cincora's papers had all, many had occurred before then. But a custodian has a view. I wouldn't be surprised at all. The documents only protect them if they rely on the directions of the swap counterparties as the secured party. As part of the forbearance agreement, Your Honor may recall, those swap counterparties consented to the continuing release of those funds to the city. Query, would U.S. Bank ever had changed releasing revenues, which it had been doing since the emergency financial manager was appointed in March? It had been doing for over a year when there was an intervening credit rating downgrade. It was doing what the secured parties wanted it to do until a communication from Cincora. And the nature of those communications, Your Honor, are probably beyond this afternoon, but they were peppered with words like demand that you hold. It was not look to your agreement. And if, in fact, 922.82 applies, if the matter of law does, and we would submit to Your Honor on these facts, it does, then there are no exceptions. The 362B exceptions that are being argued by Cincora, they don't apply in Chapter 9. There has to be another basis to come to Your Honor and seek relief from the stay. 362CD&E apply, but B doesn't. So if we're in Chapter 9 stay world, I think U.S. Bank has to think about it. I think Judge Klein and Judge Bennett, both in Stockton and all three Jeffco cases, have underscored that the exceptions to the automatic stay that one would classically rely on, police power, 362B, do not apply. So in construing that agreement, I think, which no one has done, and the custodian has zero obligation to do, a fact that's a position it has espoused in filings in the adversary proceeding now pending before Your Honor. So we know, Your Honor, that if a Chapter 9 stay applies, 362B17 doesn't. Now, if I were to take a detour with Your Honor's indulgence, bear with me, because there is a critical difference between 362B and Section 560. The way the exceptions work in the safe harbor world, it appears to us, it appears to me, first from Judge Shannon's decision in Semcrude, where he actually took the lead. He took the general proposition that the automatic stay is very broad, relying on Timbers and Mid-Atlantic, and said that exceptions really have to be construed extremely narrowly. I think we know that from him, that he looked at the safe harbors, and I want to get back to 560. It is relevant to the Chapter 9 stay. He looked at the safe harbors as saying it kind of works as a package, but fundamentally, it's about offset netting and the termination of qualifying financial contracts. In Judge Shannon's Semcrude case, Your Honor may not be aware of the facts, but it involved what the Wall Street types call a triangular set-off, which means that if one of the non-debtor parties' affiliates owes an obligation, they can set off I mean, one of the debtors' affiliates owes the counterparty an obligation. They can set off the debtor's property. The contract said that was totally permissible. They looked to 362B17, so contract right. We're exercising this. Judge Shannon, who was affirmed in his decision, said no, very narrow exception. You still have to fundamentally be entitled to set off or exercise the rights that you're seeking to exercise. So why do I want to get back to 560? 560, 561, 559 are the heart of the safe harbors. If Your Honor looks to the language of 560, unlike the language of anything in 362, including 362-0, 560, were the swap counterparties to actually be terminating the swap, says right in it, and I quote, Your Honor, that they have a right to do so, notwithstanding any provision in this title, meaning including, I would argue, 922A2, if it were the swap counterparties who were, in fact, terminating the swap. They have something they can point to. 362B has no such reference to notwithstanding anything else in this title. 362, including 362-0, operate subject to Chapter 9. So I think that when we think of the decisions, Your Honor, that have really looked at this issue, and they are, when one thinks about the qualifying financial contract decisions, outside of Chapter 9, you have to start, as I said, with Judge Shannon's decision in Semcrude on the triangular merger. Shortly after that, Judge Peck would follow again. He, too, encountered very creative arguments that banks and financial parties raised to say that they were arguing, they were asserting a contractual right that enabled them to squirt through this very narrow exception of 362B17. So even if we were only operating under the automatic stay, I think we have to look to Judge Peck's ruling against Fed Bank. And, Your Honor, that's reported on the list that I have given you at 433BR101. And that was affirmed. And Judge Buchwald, in affirming that decision, went at length through the legislative history of the safe harbors and, in fact, relied on Doosnip, the Supreme Court decision, to say, we have to pay attention to the fundamental principles. If this was designed for a set-off and a termination, that's the only time it can be used. So Fed Bank, that got the bright idea that it could have had a contractual right to do more than that, was found to have violated the stay and directed to release to Lehman the monies it was holding. Shortly after that, a name familiar to this court, Bank of America would try something very similar against Lehman. They said, gee, we also have a contract right to take your monies wherever we're holding it and apply it to your debt. And since we're involved in a swap, we should be able to do that. And, Your Honor, that case was cited in our statement to you of earlier this week. And Judge Peck said, wait a minute. No. You're not within the safe harbor, and you shouldn't have done that. You should have come to me first and demonstrated your entitlement to relief from the stay. Failing that, you found that they had, in fact, violated the stay. You would then have the opportunity, and Lehman gave Judge Peck many opportunities to deal with the safe harbors, Your Honor. Forgive me for reverting to New York decisions so often, but he would then have to deal with another triangular set-off case with UBS and the list of authorities I've given you, Your Honor. That's the Lehman case that is followed with the initials UBS. Again, following Judge Shannon's lead, no. Your contract may say, or you can argue, you're blue in the face, your contract says you can do that, but that is not permitted. That is not a right that should be recognized. It's beyond the termination of a swap and going against collateral. The case that probably gets the most press, and it was not reported, Your Honor, so I don't know your rules regarding an unreported decision. It was a decision in the transcript of Judge Peck in that case, a financial party known as Medavante, have relied on a provision in the ISDA master swap. It's very interesting. Medavante was in swap vernacular out of the money, which meant that Medavante should have been paying monies periodically into the debtor. Medavante said, wait a minute, safe harbor. I have the right to terminate the swap, and I haven't decided whether I want to or not. But I also have a contract provision, which I'm exercising under 362B17, that says I don't have to perform if the debtor is not performing. Judge Peck had little patience with that provision and said, you've waived your right to terminate on account of the bankruptcy, you haven't done it, and you can't exercise other remedies. That's not the scope of this exception known as 362B17. It's far narrower. Another bank will come along shortly thereafter, the Bank of New York. And Your Honor may be familiar, and I know that it did come up, I think, in Collins and Eggman, where there are special provision entities where there are management rights. And if one were to become a bankrupt, the management rights would flip to the non-debtor. Someone sought to enforce such provision against Lehman. They had a swap and a financial contract, and they also had this flip right. And they literally read 362B17, any contract right. Judge Peck said absolutely not. It's not confined to Wall Street cases, Your Honor. In Calpine, there was a forward contract in the energy field between Calpine and Reliant Energy. And Judge Liflin was confronted with Reliant Energy as a non-debtor trying to exercise a right, a remedy, under its contract, under 362B. Judge said, wait a minute. You're not terminating this forward. That's all that's protected in the safe harbor. It's not a roving commission to do what you want to a debtor and withhold. Your Honor, Judge Gonzalez had a similar experience in Enron when someone commenced a DEC action in state court in reliance on a remedy in their contract, and he found that that, too, was a violation of the stay. But what I'm kind of concerned about, and I certainly did not mean to concede, we're not sure, since we've heard conflicting statements, and we certainly are not conceding, that Cincora has any contract rights with respect to the casino revenues and the collateral agreement. In fact, we've heard them say they're not doing anything. To Your Honor's point earlier, they're passive. So, Your Honor, we think they can't be on all sides of this issue. We think that the automatic stay of 362A has to rise to protect property of the city of this magnitude. Your Honor, this property has substantial value. It can support substantial leverage to resolve this case. It should be protected by the automatic stay as a critical resource of the city. But its characteristic as a tax can't be ignored either, which would bring in the separate protection of Section 922A2. And, Your Honor, there's only one exception for that, and that's in the safe harbors themselves, not the exceptions from the stay. And I don't think that anyone, in light of the forbearance agreement, certainly the swap counterparties, are not terminating the swap. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the right to respond, as this was somewhat unscheduled, and we've tried to anticipate the arguments that Cincora might raise.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Stephen Hackney on behalf of Cincora. So there were a lot of cases that were referenced there. I would propose to start with each of the three arguments I think that were made as to why the stay should not apply, and I'd propose to start with the fact that we contend that the property of the casino revenues is not property of the estate. And I thought it would be helpful if I could walk the court through where exactly this property goes and how it gets to where it goes under the collateral agreement. So there, I don't think, I heard Ms. Ball say that I guess maybe they're reserving on the question of whether it's a special revenue, but these are excise taxes that we believe constitute special revenues that are imposed on the activity of gaming and gaming-related activities. They come into the hands of the casino, and then instead of being paid to the city, as they normally would be, the city gave irrevocable instructions to the casinos directing them to pay the money to U.S. Bank. And the irrevocable instructions are interesting because they also come with a release that says if you pay the money to U.S. Bank, you have no further obligation. You are released. U.S. Bank then, under the collateral agreement, sets up a number of accounts. There's an account called the holdback account, there's an account called the developer account, and there's an account called the general receipt subaccount. Put the holdback account over to this side for a moment conceptually. The developer account and the general receipt subaccount are accounts that U.S. Bank itself sets up under the collateral agreement. They are housed at in New York City, so the accounts themselves are physically outside the state of Michigan. The funds then go into the developer account, and U.S. Bank at certain times then itself transfers the funds from the developer account to the general receipt subaccount. They are only paid, and the collateral account uses the word the custodian shall make payment of the funds to the city upon the either the city fulfilling certain specific events or the non-occurrence of other events, as we contend under Section 5.4, a termination event, an event of default. If those things are happening, then the custodian shall not pay to the city the funds in the general receipt subaccount. The reason I am going through this in such detail is because the question is whether or not the casino revenues are property of the estate. I don't think it's a question as to whether the debtor has an interest in them. It certainly has an interest in them. But that is not tantamount to saying that it is property of the estate. Here,
what's the nature of that interest that you concede?
What we have analogized it to, Your Honor, is a residual interest like one in an escrow account. And, in fact, I think we have made an argument in our papers that the collateral agreement does create an escrow account under New York law. It has the hallmarks of an escrow.
Would you agree it's a contingent interest?
Yeah, I think I would think of it as residual, but I think contingent maybe is also accurate in the sense that it is contingent upon a number of things either coming to pass or not coming to pass before the city has a right to receive the property. But we have cited the cases to you that we cited.
Let me ask you to pause one more time.
Oh, you bet.
For what, you know, will seem like a silly question, but I'm going to put it to you anyway. If it's not the debtor's property, whose is it?
I think that the answer to that is that it is property of the custodian. The custodian has title to the property, has control and possession over the property. There are other people that have interest in the property. The service corporations have an interest in the property by operation of the city pledge to them.
The custodian has no beneficial interest in the property.
I would have to think about that some more. The custodian is entitled to...
There are no circumstances under which the money would ever go to the custodian for the custodian's own use and benefit, right?
I will have to duck that one, Your Honor, and say I'm not sure. Just because there are circumstances where, in its role as contract administrator, the contract administrator is allowed to pay itself some of its fees, I don't know if the custodian has similar provisions that say, oh, by the way, before I kick the money out, I get to hold back the X, Y, and Z. I'm not saying it does. I'm just saying I'm not certain. I can't concede it from the podium. But so does the service corporation have an interest in this property that is the property of the custodian? Yes. Does
All right,
the swap
let's
counterparty?
Stop there.
Yeah.
Assuming for the moment that the city has even a contingent interest in the money on deposit in this account, isn't any attempt to exercise control over that contingent interest stayed by Section 362A3?
Yeah, I guess I would say we don't believe so, Your Honor, because of the cases that we have cited that say where in the context of an escrow, all the debtor has is a contingent interest that isn't sufficient to establish that the property is property of the estate. And so the stay does not apply in the first instance. And I would note that we have also cited cases to this
effect. What's the logic behind that? I ask that because in every other circumstance I can think of where a debtor has a contingent interest in property, that contingent interest is considered to be property of the estate protected by the automatic stay. Why would an escrow agreement be any different?
Well, I can only say that I guess reason number one would be certainly that we've cited cases suggesting that it is, but in terms of the policies behind those cases,
okay.
I think the policies are that there is value to having certainty with respect to security that's been granted by a debtor that is no longer under its possession or control. And so you can see a situation where if the debtor, I can see where the debtor is driving its car around, but yes, it's pledged the title to a bank there. The debtor still retains the primary possession and ownership of the property. The creditor there's interest is a security interest that they're not allowed to foreclose upon without violating the automatic stay. I understand that is an example where there are contingencies to the debtor's interest, but it's got the hallmarks of possession and control, and it's actually using the car. Where I think things change from the standpoint of the bankruptcy code, they certainly change from the standpoint of the cases that we've cited, is where the debtor now gives the car as well to the bank that's also holding the title and saying, now this is property that can be held pursuant to this agreement. I can only get it back in these certain circumstances.
So if under state law a creditor has a possessory security interest in property, your position would be that that creditor is not required to seek relief from the stay because the stay doesn't apply? That's an extraordinary position to take.
Where the creditor has a possessory interest in...
It holds possession of the property as a secured creditor under state law, like a pawn shop or a bank that holds a CD, for example, as a security interest.
What I would say is that the escrow cases we have cited, I think, read on to that circumstance that you've identified, which is that, yes, where the maintenance of the escrow, the continued operation of the escrow subsequent to the bankruptcy filing, does not constitute a violation of the automatic stay.
Well, but that would only be because the stay doesn't apply, right?
That is correct. I mean, I'm not trying to assume the conclusion, but I'm saying the cases that we have cited were considering the question of whether or not the maintenance of the escrow violated the automatic stay because of the fact that the debtor did have potentially a residual interest in the property that was in the escrow account. And what those cases said is the debtor's residual interest does not rise to the level of making the property of the estate. Part of the reason we're analogizing to them is we do think at some point the rubber has to meet the road in terms of looking at...
Well, but there are a gazillion cases that say a secured creditor who's in possession of collateral must turn that over to the debtor, and to the debtor, and the creditor's relief is to ask for adequate protection, right?
Your Honor, I have...
Law outside of Chapter 9?
I have to say I... I will say, Your Honor, I'm not familiar with those cases as I stand here today. I prepared on the cases that were cited in the city's papers. It does seem to me, though, that to the extent those cases hold that way, that the creditor has to pay the money over to the debtor, they may be distinguishable from the escrow context, wherein the escrow is specifically designed to capture the money while different parties' potential rights are assessed. So I can only say that the cases we have cited are ones in which it's agreed that the debtor has a contingent and residual interest to the property potentially someday, but it doesn't have either possession or control of the property, we have cited cases saying that the operation of the escrow is not outside the automatic stay. Your Honor, I would like to speak briefly, if I could, to the question of the pledged special revenues. So I don't think that there's a real debate that as to whether these are pledged special revenues. I understand counsel is, I guess, reserved on that, but they are excise taxes. There's an opinion from Orrick Harrington that was issued in connection with the 2009 collateral agreements formation, identifying the wagering taxes as excise taxes, and Mr. Orr himself in his proposal identified them as such. So I think what I'd like to turn to, though, is the city's argument that there is not going to be any application to indebtedness because the fact that they're staying current on the swap. And I want to address this because I think this misapprehends the precise nature of the structure, because the obligations to make the periodic swap payments are the obligations of the service corporation. The city's obligations that are secured by the city's pledge of these revenues are obligations under the service contracts. All of the city's obligations under the service contracts have accelerated as a result of the city's bankruptcy filing. So we disagree with the fact that the city is current with respect to its obligations under the service contract that the city pledge secures. So I think that argument by the city misses the mark.
Is that acceleration legal?
To the best of my knowledge, it is, Your Honor. It's provided for in the service contracts that the city signed that contain numerous opinions that were rendered with them regarding the legality of those contracts.
Is there any other indebtedness you rely on?
Well, I guess what I would say is that the ultimate application of the wagering revenues to the obligations of the service corporations under the swap in the future would also be potential indebtedness that would require the trapping now. For example, if Mr. Orr decides I'm going to stop paying the swap in light of the fact that the trap is valid, then the payments will be made out of the trapped funds via the
Assume your argument is accurate as far as it goes. That is to say, the party holding the lien can proceed. How does that help you? Why does that suggest that there's no stay against Cincora? Because Cincora does not have a lien.
Well, first of all, the language of Section 922D is not versed in the language of who possesses the right in question, which distinguishes it from something like 362B17, which we'll get to in a moment, which talks about swap participants. But let me answer your question head on, Your Honor, and say that remember that this is an integrated transaction, and so the collateral agreement not only takes pains to integrate itself into the swaps agreement, the services agreement, and the contract administration agreement, the swaps agreement also makes clear that the services contract, the collateral agreement, and the contract administration agreement are all credit support documents underneath the swap agreement. Now, the significance of this, Your Honor, is that the way this structure works is that because Cincora possesses the, along with FGIC, but because the insurers possess the ultimate economic exposure here to the structure, the system, the structure gives them the power to enforce the various agreements and the right to direct the actions of other people. So if you look at the swaps agreement, for example, Cincora is an explicit third-party beneficiary with the rights to enforce the obligations underneath the swap agreement, which, as I've noted, is integrated with these other agreements. Under the services contract, it's also an explicit third-party beneficiary with the rights of enforcement. And what is also unique is that under the contract administration agreement, it has the rights to direct the actions of the service corporation, the custodian, and the swap counterparties. The reason for that, Your Honor, is in order to remain in control of a structure that it's ultimately going to be paying people on, if you default on your insurance, you lose these control and direction rights. So you have to be staying current. which Cencora has done. But the significant, I'm trying to be responsive to your point, which is to say they keep saying, you know, it's like a drum they're beating to say that what they're really saying, Your Honor, is Cencora is not a signatory to the collateral agreement. And you know what? They're right. Cencora is not a signatory to the collateral agreement. But you should know that its consent was required to enter into the collateral agreement. It is a notice party under the collateral agreement. There are provisions in the collateral agreement that say that in order to exercise its rights under the collateral agreement, it must not be in default of its credit insurance, that harken back to the other provisions in the services agreement and the swap and the contract administration agreement that talk about not being in default of your credit insurance. And so Cencora is absolutely a party in interest and a third-party beneficiary with rights of enforcement, and that would entail the right to direct the conduct of the swap counterparty. So even if the court decided under 922D, it is important to me, the court, that the party asserting 922D's exemption of special revenues being applied to indebtedness have some connection to that. What I'm telling you, Your Honor, is we absolutely do, because that's the way these agreements are designed to work in terms of the control, the consent, and the direction rights. Your Honor, I was going to speak briefly to the question of Section 362B17 of the Bankruptcy Code, if I may.
Yes.
So the key argument here, there is not a suggestion, I don't believe, that the swap's not a swap, that the collateral agreement isn't a security agreement within the meaning of a swap agreement, which, by the way, extends to agreements beyond just the swap agreement. I think the sole argument that the city's making here is that Cencora is not a swap participant. And so I think I would not belabor or repeat the arguments that I all just made about the way Cencora is intimately connected to and has the powers of different aspects of the agreements to both enforce them directly and to direct other parties to do things, including the swap counterparties. So from my standpoint, at a functional level, if you look at the language as to whether Cencora is a participant in the swap, it fits within the plain language, not only because it has potential economic exposure to it, but also because it has rights of enforcement and it has rights to direct the swap counterparties underneath the swap. To me, that makes it a swap participant under the plain language. There is a dearth of authority on this question. We've researched it to say, can we find a case one way or the other? And while I'll start as an advocate by telling you that we found no case saying that a swap insurer is not a swap participant, I'll also be candid and tell you that we haven't found a case that says that a swap insurer is a swap participant. So we're somewhat in a case of first impression. But I wanted to offer you two notes. The first is that Lehman case that they did cite in their briefs, which is I would describe as a highly distinguishable case. There was Lehman involved, I believe, Bank of America is attempting to use its role as a custodian in one context to grab the money and use it to set off against an unrelated agreement that it believed it had with Lehman. And not only was it held not to have the set-off rights, which were the premise for what it was doing, it was also that it certainly shouldn't be using the amounts it was holding as custodian in order to try and set off its other obligations. So Lehman is an apposite. Obviously, we take the admonitions to be cautious with respect to this day seriously, and I'm not diminishing them. But here's what is interesting about Lehman, I think, which is when Bank of America invoked Section 362B17 in Lehman, it was just a custodian. You know, I mean, they're a signatory to a swap, but are they really a participant in the swap? They're not somebody that's going to benefit from the swap one way or the other. And the court in that case never said, you're not a swap participant. It said, I will address your argument on the merits as to whether Section 362B17 applies, and then concluded that it did not. And I think that's significant because Cencora is absolutely a market participant in connection with these swaps. Swap insurance is a common aspect of the market. And so to ignore the practical realities, I think, would ignore some of the purposes of the safe harbor. I would also note that we were able to find language from Colliers, and this is 5 Collier on Bankruptcy, 560.031. And what it said was, The special protections for swap agreements provided by Section 560 and other provisions of the Bankruptcy Code are available to all parties to swap agreements with the debtor because the term swap participant is broadly defined in Section 101-53C to mean an entity that at any time before the filing of the petition has an outstanding swap agreement with the debtor. Thus, the swap protections are generally available to all parties who could benefit therefrom. That's obviously.
Are you cite any cases in support of that?
It does not in the provision I'm reading. So take it for what it's worth, Your Honor. I understand it's not the same as the Supreme Court opinion 9-0. But in short, I think that if you take a functional look at the purposes of the Safe Harbor Act, it was designed to provide certainty with respect to swap participants, with respect to things like collateral agreements.
Well, how do you deal with Ms. Ball's argument that under 922B, Section 362B does not apply?
Yeah, so under 922, and I'm sorry, was that?
B.
I want to make sure. There was an argument made under 922A2. That these are the collection of taxes. Am I miss?
Well, 922A2, yes.
And then?
It's a stay applicable to all entities of the enforcement of a lien on or arising out of taxes or assessments owed to the debtor. There's that stay.
Yeah.
But there's nothing that suggests that B, the exceptions in B, 362B, apply to that stay.
Okay, so at the first level argument, Your Honor, is that under Section 922D, what 922D says, notwithstanding Section 362 of this title and subsection A of this section. So even if Ms. Ball were correct, and I will tell you why we don't concede that she is, they still have to run the rapids of 922D because it specifically accepts 922A. The second thing I will tell you, Your Honor, is that I would say we have conducted research on this, and we were, if I'm not mistaken, only able to find one case that related to this provision, and it's in my iPhone, so I don't have it for you because you have to turn your iPhone off in the courtroom. So, which is a good rule because we're all too connected. But anyway, I was reading the case over lunchtime, and what my associate told me was he was only able to find one case where this was invoked, and the case there involved confusion or attempts to collect taxes by an entity that was distinct from the debtor. I don't believe that this is currently the enforcement of a lien against arising out of the taxes or assessments owed to the debtor. This is the natural operation of the collateral agreement, the irrevocable instructions that were entered into long ago. So there is no action that's being taken by someone. That's what's frustrating to the city. It is the inaction, the refusal to transmit the monies that the city has set by the dead hand of the collateral agreement and the irrevocable instructions to flow directly to the
I keep tripping over that. There's lots of case law that says that Section 362 doesn't distinguish much between action and inaction. And I assume that case law would apply to 922 because it's the same language, if not the same policy. How do I deal with that here?
Well, you would deal with it first by saying that it only applies to property of the debtor, ab initio. So you do have to get to that stage. And then second, even if we are on the subject of action versus inaction being irrelevant, you also do have to find that 920.
What the cases say is that there are many circumstances in which the inaction of a creditor constitutes the exercise of control over the debtor's property.
But in those cases, I'm going to surmise, there is a finding that it is property of the debtor. And there's I also don't want to assume the conclusion the other way against me, which is we have a threshold question that says it's not property of the debtor.
Okay, so there's two different issues. The first is what is at stake property of the debtor? The The second issue is what the debtor is doing in relation to that property and exercise of control over it.
That's right. And that the nine.
What the cases say is that on the second issue, the issue of exercise of control, inaction can be an exercise of control.
And I think and not to forget that 922D is also an exception to 922A2.
Right.
But I think Mr. Bennett's handed me a helpful note, and hopefully I'm doing him justice. But what he points out is we are not seeking to interfere with the contingent interest that the city does have. It is merely that the property, which is not the city's property, is the cash itself, continue to be trapped. So that is the distinction there, which, again, folds back into our argument that it's not property of the estate. Your Honor, I have said my piece. I think we may have exhausted my knowledge of bankruptcy law as well. So thank you very much, Your Honor.
Anyone else briefly without duplicating what's already been said?
Yes, Your Honor. Good afternoon again. Guy Neal, Sidley Austin, counsel for National Public Finance Guarantee Corp. I rise to echo to echo and to underscore what Ms. Ball said about her reservations as it relates to the special revenue determination. And without treating this as a complete reservation of rights, which I know is not something I need to do, I would encourage Your Honor to expressly reserve or avoid ruling on the issue of whether or not these are special revenues such that they are accepted from the automatic stay. NPFG, among others, I think about 12 or 13 others, have filed an objection to the swap forbearance motion, will be an active participant in discovery, will litigate this issue on the 9th. And those threshold issues that are raised, and there are just three of them, so I will be brief, that were raised in NPFG's objection, or technically NPFG's joinder to AMBAC's objection, is that the swap obligations are unauthorized under state law and therefore void. State law does not authorize the city to pledge casino revenue to secure swap obligations. And third, the casino revenue does not constitute special revenue, and accordingly, the swap counterparties do not have a lien on post-petition casino revenue. I think these were the same three issues that Ms. Ball appropriately reserved on. Those are issues that have been extensively briefed and will be extensively argued and litigated on the 9th. So I would ask Your Honor, in your ruling today, not to foreclose any argument, or foreclose us, excuse me, and others who, frankly, are not here in the courtroom today, including Assured and AMBAC this afternoon, to make these arguments on the 9th.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Gordon, you rose.
I did, Your Honor, and the vagaries of going second, Mr. Neal said everything I wanted to say, but just for the record, we support the same position. It was our understanding that the arguments today were simply as to whether the stay had any effect on Cincora as a third party, not standing in the shoes of a swap participant. Those issues are really to be dealt with on the 9th. Thank you.
Anybody else before we get back to Ms. Ball? One more? Yes?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Vanessa Fluker, standing in for the Attorney of Record Jerome Goldberg on behalf of Interested Party David Saul. I do concur with Ms. Ball's arguments. I would just like to highlight a couple points that I think add something to that, and that is, number one, that the gravamen of this whole issue is whether we have a special revenue here. And I think that is significant. Counsel for Cincora made an argument about the escrow, and it was very eloquent, but the bottom line is the escrow was created based on the alleged lien that was on the revenue that came into the city via the waging taxes. Therefore, it's incumbent to be able to ascertain whether, in fact, this is special revenue, which, pursuant to statute, it obviously is. If you look not only at the definition under 902, but also if you look at the Michigan statute that allocates the revenue, it specifically articulates purposes that the revenue could be used for, including hiring, training of street patrol officers, neighborhood, downtown, economic developments. It's just a laundry list of things that it could be used for. So to say that it was specifically earmarked for the payment of Cencora as a custodian, I think that is a far stretch, particularly when you have statutes
not
incorporating
on the list.
This. That is correct. They're not on the list. Exactly. Therefore, we believe that obviously the stay is applicable, and just based on pure statutory construction, in addition to the collateral agreement itself that does not specifically isolate all of these funds that would make it constitute a special revenue as defined by Section 902. And I do concur, as I indicated, with Attorney Ball.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Ms. Ball?
If I may, I rise for, I think, a very short list of points, but two of them are critical. I have a picture, which I think lays out what Mr. Hackney tried to describe to you. I have one for Mr. Hackney as well. May I approach, Your Honor?
Yes.
I think Your Honor has appropriately cautioned Cencora regarding the fact that secured creditors remain subject to the automatic stay, even if they're the IRS. Your Honor may recall Whiting Pools, where the IRS had seized property and similarly claimed it's no longer property of the debtor. The Supreme Court's told us that's clearly not true. And in fact, as I mentioned to you earlier, Judge Bennett, in his assessment in Jefferson County as to whether or not possession by the receiver removed revenues from the state of Jefferson County, simply included no. But I want to get back to three things that Mr. Hackney said. On this picture, Your Honor, has nothing to do with any agreement other than the collateral agreement. And all the payments that are required to be made are not made under the service contract, as alleged by Mr. Hackney. As a matter of fact, there are payments. The casinos every day are directed to pay revenues into that general receipts subaccount. Monthly, under the collateral agreement, the payments are made by the city, under the collateral agreement, into the holdback account. Once the city makes that payment into the holdback account, every day, not remote in the future, not at the end of the year, every day, casino revenues are released in that monthly cycle. So monthly payments are made by the city under the collateral agreement. Never goes near the service corp, the service contract, its contractual obligation under the collateral agreement. Similarly, under the collateral agreement, the city has the right to obtain a release of its funds from the holdback, from the general receipts account, every day until the next monthly cycle begins. So the city has a contract right under the collateral agreement to have monies released to it from its monies released to it from the general receipts subaccount on a daily basis, every day in the month, after
what
it has made
payment. What
paragraph
of the agreement are you referring to?
Pardon?
I'm sorry. What paragraph of the agreement?
Paragraph 5.2 of the collateral agreement, Your Honor. And then the payments to the city from the holdback account are in Section 5.5. So everything works here in a closed circle under this agreement that Cencora is not a party to. The other point, which I think goes to the application of special revenues to indebtedness, again, assuming arguendo, that the special, that the casino revenues are special revenues. The only obligation for which the casino revenues stand as collateral is the hedge payable. Payments under the swap. Very clear in the grant of the security interest under the collateral agreement that that is the scope of the city pledge, and that is in section 4.1. Well, I know it has been, well, I don't know, it just seems that it's been fundamental to the approach that my colleagues representing Cencora have taken, that this really is a complex, interrelated, multiple, multi-party, everybody's in the game situation. Your Honor, that world changed, and it changed radically in 2009. And what changed in 2009? And I want to get to the Cencora consent. What happened in 2009? Well, as Your Honor may be aware from all the papers, there was a downgrade of the city. But the city wasn't the only one on its heels. The insurers had been downgraded, and there had been an insurer event under the swap as well. So here everyone was facing the prospect in 2009 of a massive default by the city and a massive amount of money due. The city did the responsible thing. The banks kind of had everybody. We were all on our heels. City, Cencora, FGIC, nobody was in tremendous shape in 2009. I'm sure it's a time that Your Honor recalls well, particularly in this part of the country. So what happened in 2009? We've heard a lot about the banks got collateral. Well, that's true, and I want to come back to that. Two major things happened in 2009. We focused on one. One was the city gave the swap counterparties collateral in this closed circuit agreement under a document which was not only the insurers weren't a party to it, but Your Honor, also cities are careful. Kudos to them. In the section that my colleagues also want to quote to Your Honor, which the rest of us might refer to as a merger clause, you know, section 14A, that all these other documents constitute the entire agreement of the parties. It's very interesting because there are three places, and I would dare our colleagues to find more, where the word insurer is even mentioned in the collateral agreement. And it's mentioned in that merger section. You know what it says? This section does not apply to any rights and obligations of the insurers. The insurers had nothing to do with the collateral agreement. Why? Because a second change happened in 2009. And, Your Honor, it was very obvious because the ordinance of the city in that summer of 2009 had a term sheet. And the term sheet kind of highlighted it very nicely. It laid out in gory detail the fact that the city was now going to pay a higher rate of interest to the banks, was going to put up collateral, but it also provided for the end of the hedge. It severed the tie between the COPs, which are the certificates of participation, insured, the other insurance obligation by Cencora that has nothing to do with the swaps. And Cencora disagrees with that construction, but it, in essence, said to the banks, you get a free, get out of jail free card. You can walk away from these swaps anytime you want. And you know, Your Honor, when do you think a rational financial player is going to walk away from those swaps? When they're going to be out of the money for the banks. So rather than ever have to pay a nickel, the banks got the right to just wash their hands and say, we walk. Well, that's a radical change, Your Honor. That meant that the hedge could never really be of value to the city. It was never going to the service corps, excuse me, who's never going to be in the money. That was kind of a radical change. But it was consistent with the city's view that we are pledging this incredible revenue stream, the last big one we have, to the banks. And we want to be able to get it back. So if those swaps are terminated, we only have to deal with you, and we'll get our revenue stream back. But that is an immense change, Your Honor. And what's very interesting, and I have copies with me, should Your Honor want to walk through this with me. Mr. Hertzberg, perhaps you can help me. Mr. Hackney is 100% correct that Cencora was asked to consent to everything that happened in 2009. And I have with me, Your Honor, a copy of their waiver and consent. May I approach?
Yes.
Your Honor, in the third paragraph on the first page of that waiver and consent, you have one in the file there.
All right, I'll let you describe this to me briefly, but
Your Honor, I only suffice it to say all the agreements that they consented to were appended to their consent. And in fact, Cencora did consent, not once, but four different times, because they had four different policies on four different swaps to this amendment that broke the hedge, that broke the tie.
Okay, so what does this have to do with whether the stay is applicable,
Your Honor,
in
it goes
the circumstances
to the
that we're talking about here?
Sorry, it goes to any debt unpaid on the COPS or the service are so far afield from this pledge and should not be countenanced in the context of suggesting that 922D is applicable here. It is only payments under the swap, and they have all been timely made. And all the payments and our contract rights to get the release of revenues are under the collateral agreement. And that's a right that we believe the automatic stay and the stay of Chapter 9 protect. It is not a very complicated series of many other things. The city pays every month. Thereafter, every day, they get their revenues, their tax revenues. Your Honor, I think there should be no doubt that it remains property of the city throughout. And I think, as I said earlier, the remedy section of the collateral agreement, which is the only way to get remedies, should they trap, also provides that you have to go through all the hoops to get to that property because it's city property. And you only get there by appropriation. So to suggest that it ever ceases being property of the city is totally contrary to this agreement, which is the agreement by which these revenues are delivered to the custodian. I can see everyone in my welcome, Your Honor. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions?
Just a brief rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
I will resist the temptation. I'm not always good at resisting temptations, but I'm not going to argue the way the structure works in our interpretation, because it's super technical, and I don't believe it's germane here. So I'm going to just respectfully disagree with Ms. Ball. But I want to address the diagram, because you'll remember that in my argument, I said that the payments under the service contract, which the city pledge definitely secures, had all accelerated, so that there is a disagreement with us, with their contention that the city is current. They're holding this diagram up to say, no, look, the amounts go directly to the counterparties from the holdback account. I only want to tell you that this is a very technical point, but under section 5.7A1 of the collateral agreement, it says payments to the counterparties and the custodian from the holdback account, and it says the custodian shall pay to the counterparties from the holdback account at the end of each quarterly period, so these are the 3 months that have now stacked up, an amount equal to all hedge periodic payables, capital HPP. hedge periodic payables are defined in the service contract as a periodic amount owing by the corporation under a stated hedge. So the only reason I'm making this hyper-technical point is to say that to the extent these payments are made to the counterparties, they are made for the ultimate benefit of the service corporation, which is, of course, the party to the swap. The only other limited point I wanted to make, Your Honor, is that in Section 14.14, where Ms. Ball said there's this sort of curious reference to Cencora, it says, words the effect of Cencora's rights and obligations shall be unaffected by this section does not apply to any rights or obligations of the capital I insurers. This is the integration provision of the collateral agreement. Obviously, a quick reminder that the swap itself references the collateral agreement, the services contracts, and the contract administration agreements as credit support documents, so there's integration on that end as well. But more importantly, I think all this is doing is noting that Cencora's insurance obligation contracts are not referenced in the various documents that are part of the integration. And we are not claiming that we're coming through one of our insurance documents and exercising direct rights. We are claiming that we have enforcement and consent and direction rights as third-party beneficiaries explicitly in the agreements. That's all I think that provision is designed to do. Thank you for your patience today, Your Honor.
All right. The court will take this under advisement and either issue a written opinion before next Wednesday or give it to you on the record at that time when we reconvene on the discovery and disclosure issue.
Your Honor,
I'm sorry,
to the extent there was any failing in my presentation today to respond to some of your questions, I wanted you to know that we would be happy to submit additional pleadings. I know that you get a lot of pleadings every day, but
okay.
There were some questions you posed that if you'd like more, we'd be happy to.
In the meantime, the court will maintain the status quo, whatever that is. At some point, in light of the city's agreement to dissolve the TRO, perhaps after the court rules on the stay motion, the two of you can prepare an order and submit it to the court that accomplishes that. There is one more matter that I want to discuss with certain parties. And I'm looking at the attorney. What?
I'm sorry. On the order dissolving the injunction, could they circulate it to the casino so we could make sure the language protects us for making payments in the interim and not being at risk if they have to pay them a second time?
Any objection to that?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so I want to have a conversation with certain attorneys, but not with everyone. So I need a show of hands. Who here represents parties who are signatories to any of the agreements that have been discussed here today? Okay, if your hand is not raised, I'm going to ask you to leave the courtroom at this time. That includes members of the press and the public. I'm going to ask you to leave the courtroom at this time if you do not represent a party to one of these agreements. Turn it off. Turn it off.